who have a very stiff upper lip and repress or conceal their emotions are slightly less likely to think like a Roman emperor.
Great.
Welcome to The Max, a podcast for leaders and entrepreneurs. Hosted by Fiefma Krammer.
Hi there. This is episode number 3 of The Max podcast. I have a very interesting guest. I made this one with care and love. And the one thing I would like you to do is subscribe to my channel. I will be very grateful if you do. But with no further ado, let's start the interview.
Donald, it's a real honor to have you here. Donald, you are an author of 6 books and wrote a lot of articles about philosophy and psychotherapy. And you are a trainer and cognitive behavioral therapist. And you play an important role in the Stoic Week. Mm-hmm. And can you tell us, what is the Stoic Week? Because I know there are a lot of people coming there or attending, growing each year, and I believe about 8,000. Mm-hmm. So can you tell me, what is the Stoic Week?
Well, there's a bit of a backstory to it, but basically Stoic Week is an online course that's free and it's open to everyone around the world to do. We do it once a year, usually in the autumn, and each day, so there's 7 different topics, a different topic each day. And it's meant to give people an introduction to Stoicism as a way of life, and I designed it along with some of the other members of our team, particularly Christopher Gill, who's the founder of Modern Stoicism Organization. He's Professor Emeritus of Ancient Thought at Exeter University.
Yep.
And so it's run by an organization that was founded in 2012 by Chris Gill and others, called the Modern Stoicism Organization.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So because I attended the Stoic Week maybe last week, I believe. And the nice thing about the Stoic Week is not only that they talk about the theoretical part of the Stoicism, but also that you have to do things.
Mm-hmm.
And
this idea.
Yeah.
Philosophy is a way of life.
That's true. Yeah, yeah. Well, I heard you say once, Stoic philosophy or Stoic life is not for Christmas.
Yeah.
It's for your life.
Not for Christmas.
Yeah.
It's bigger. And also, it's today, and this is a caricature, but sometimes we might say now philosophy is almost like something that we do in libraries and in classrooms, whereas ancient philosophy was something that was done in life generally.
Yep.
And sometimes people like to call it a Western yoga.
Yeah.
So to try and capture this idea of what it once was.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. What I think that's so interesting about Stoic philosophy, because it's so practical.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not only talking about all different difficult things, but it's quite useful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Like of all the, so this idea, so according to some accounts, Socrates, some ancient authors say that it was Socrates who took the methods of the earlier philosophers, the pre-Socratic philosophers, and they wanted to try and understand nature, metaphysics.
Mm-hmm.
And Socrates was the first to really focus on questions about applied ethics. So he took philosophy and he started to ask, what is justice, what is courage, what is wisdom, and ask questions that would affect the way that we go about living our lives. And then when he died, he was executed, there were 10 Socratic sects, according to the tradition. They all kind of split off and focused on different fragments of his thinking. And Plato, who was his most famous follower, founded the Academy, and they adopted a more metaphysical, slightly more speculative interpretation of Socrates. And the Stoics, I think, were very dissatisfied with this. They thought that Plato hadn't really done justice to the original Socrates, and they wanted to get back to the sort of philosophy that Socrates was doing in the agora, in the street, teaching people how to live differently.
Mm-hmm.
And of all the different schools of philosophy that existed a few generations after Socrates, in what we call the Hellenistic period after Alexander the Great, the Stoics were probably the one, maybe along with the Epicureans, that placed the most emphasis on practical techniques and how philosophy could function as a kind of psychological therapy.
Yeah. Well, you can read this in your book as well, because your latest book is called How to Think Like a Roman Emperor. Mm. And this book was the number one bestseller in philosophy in the United States. And I completely understand why. I'm a big fan of you, you already know, but probably a little bit more fan of Marcus Aurelius. Mm-hmm. And this book is all about Marcus, so that's what I like about the book. Mm-hmm. And Marcus was one of the best Roman emperors. And I understand you wanted to know who he was and what a great leader he was. Mm-hmm. Is that correct?
Yeah, I've always wanted to understand more about Marcus and how everyone loves the Meditations. It's one of the most loved spiritual self-help classics in European literature.
Yep.
And it's a strange book. There are a number of strange things about the Meditations. So one of them is that although Marcus does sometimes, especially in book one, he talks a lot about his family members and his tutors. But throughout the rest of the book, it's kind of vague.
Yeah.
He doesn't say anything specific about the circumstances that he finds himself in. So for instance, I'll give you an example of that. One of the most widely quoted passages from the Meditations is book two, passage one. And he says, every morning when you wake up, tell yourself that you're going to meet meddling people, treacherous people, deceitful people, and so on. And he mentally rehearses how he's going to cope with this. And I think when people read this today, they project themselves into
True.
It's really vague.
It's timeless. That's why it's timeless, yeah.
They think my boss is like that. It makes it timeless. They think my mother-in-law is like that. But Marcus doesn't say who he's talking about.
No.
And throughout the rest of the Meditations, he leaves it kind of vague like that. But of course, we know from his life that he may well have been talking about, he faced, for example, a civil war.
Yeah.
And also when the Germanic tribes and the Sarmatians invaded across the northern frontier, that was a betrayal because Rome had a peace treaty with them. So he's maybe thinking about these diplomatic problems and these the political conflict at Rome, these world historic, epoch-shaping, history-shaping events.
Yeah.
When he says, today when you get up, you might face someone who's treacherous.
Yeah, that's true.
But we don't see that because he doesn't fill in the details. And that the beauty of it is that allows us to identify with what he's saying. It makes it, as you said, a timeless classic.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, I wanted to know more about what he was talking about. Because
yeah.
I also found that if I could imagine specific events that he might be referring to, it added another dimension, it added a level of richness to my understanding of Marcus.
Yeah. Do you say the situations that he describes are quite vague? Do you think he did that on purpose? What do you think?
I think he must have. There are a number of artfully vague things about the way that he writes. That's one of them. And I'm not sure why he did it, but I think he clearly did it on purpose. I think sometimes, although there are clues in that text that suggest it was written for private consumption, I don't think it was intended for publication.
Mm.
I agree with the consensus among most scholars. It doesn't look like it was intended for publication.
Yeah.
Nevertheless, it's tempting to think that maybe he left some of the names out because he was being diplomatic. He didn't want to name specific individuals. But he also says things, for example, another odd thing about the way he writes, Marcus was the adopted grandson of the Emperor Hadrian.
Yeah.
And he mentions Hadrian in the Meditations, but only very fleetingly in passing, I think about three times or so. And at the beginning, when he's going through these lists of qualities of people that he admires, he talks at great length about his predecessor, his adoptive father, Antoninus Pius. But he says nothing there about Hadrian. And particularly for Romans, to ignore somebody, especially to ignore someone important, was quite insulting. They talk about damning the memory of people that they really despise, just never mentioning their name again. And Hadrian was a controversial figure. So I wonder if Marcus is deliberately leaving Hadrian out.
Yeah.
And also when the things he says about Antoninus, curiously, many of them, maybe even all of the things he says about Antoninus Pius, sound like implicit criticisms of Hadrian. Mm. So he says, for instance, strangely, he said, no one could ever accuse Antoninus Pius of being a sophist. Well, that's exactly what they said about Hadrian, who yeah. loved the sophists and embraced them, yeah. and wanted to be a sophist. And yeah. so it often sounds like in brackets after all the things he says about Antoninus Pius, you could say, unlike Hadrian. Like, so this is another odd thing about it. He does seem to be sending us a message by omission, by certain things that he leaves out,
yeah.
by also the implication of some of the things he's saying.
Yeah.
But I wrote an article recently. Something odd happened in the 19th century. An Italian scholar called Angelo May discovered a cache of letters between Marcus Aurelius and Marcus Cornelius Fronto, his rhetoric tutor, mm-hmm. family friend, a sophist. And so we have this curious insight into his real private life. We can see how he was talking to one of his best friends.
Yeah.
So it allows us to see past all the pomp and ceremony of the emperor into how he actually talked to people that were close to him.
Mm.
It's very revealing. And the first thing that strikes anyone reading it, I think, is that Marcus is a very affable, very likeable, incredibly affectionate man.
Yeah.
You know, he's not kind of a cold fish, as people sometimes assume from the Meditations. And he also shows, we can see real evidence in those letters of Marcus having tremendous diplomacy and tact. He resolves an argument between Fronto and another really famous historical figure, a guy called Herodes Atticus, who was a Greek sophist. And they fall out and they have a legal battle, and Marcus tries to resolve this dispute between them. He does it very adeptly, very skillfully. So we can see this is a man who has tremendous tact.
Yeah.
And that, again, is odd because the predecessors of the Stoics, the Cynics, were known for paretia, that plain speaking. Diogenes the Cynic.
Quite direct.
Speak his mind.
Yeah.
Uncensored.
Yeah.
And the Stoics also wanted to speak truth, but they felt that it needed to be put across in such a way that the other person would be able to receive it, to hear it. So Marcus, in those letters, there's also something quite odd that stands out, which is that Fronto tells Marcus a technique for writing. And he says to him something I think is absolutely fascinating. So there was a battle. We can see Fronto was Marcus's main tutor. But he also had a Stoic tutor, a philosophy tutor called Junius Rusticus.
Hmm.
And there's a power struggle between Marcus's two teachers over who's his main one. And Fronto, we can see, kind of panicking a little bit that he's losing his student to philosophy. And Junius Rusticus wins, and he becomes the Stoic mentor of Marcus, his main tutor. And we can see Fronto kind of pitching this case to Marcus about the relationship between rhetoric on the one hand and philosophy, which were traditionally seen as clashing from the kind of dynamic between Socrates and the sophist onwards. It was viewed that rhetoric was about manipulating truth and deceiving people, whereas philosophy was about getting to plain facts, and it was thought that these two things don't sit comfortably together. And Fronto puts this argument to Marcus. He says that philosophers struggle to articulate ideas that are original and subtle. They have to often make subtle distinctions.
Mm-hmm.
And to do that, they perhaps need to introduce neologisms and say things that seem paradoxical or contrary to popular opinion. And so it takes sometimes study to understand the nuance of what they're saying.
Yeah.
And so Fronto says to Marcus, that's all and well. You'll get these original concepts, these fine distinctions from the philosophers, but you also have to be able to articulate these ideas clearly. Otherwise, it's confusing to other people and perhaps also to oneself. And so Fronto says rhetoric is necessary to complement philosophy. You need to find the right words to express your meaning, and therefore you should paraphrase.
Mm.
You should practice saying something repeatedly, maybe three or four times, until you hit on the right analogy, the right metaphor, the perfect word to articulate.
Perfect match,
And so I'd say two things about this book we love, The Meditations, that we can clearly see in it that Marcus is doing the thing that Fronto tells him to do in those letters. he repeats the same ideas over and over again in different words.
Mm.
And also, if we look at the Greek compared to the discourses of Epictetus, which were actually written by Arrian, who was a highly successful Roman statesman and general, they weren't written by Epictetus, a very literary man.
Mm-hmm.
But nevertheless, Epictetus's discourses are quite repetitive and formulaic, and they use a fairly limited vocabulary. But Marcus, as someone who's studied rhetoric for decades, has a very extensive vocabulary, and he uses unusual words in the meditation. So again, you can see him struggling to find an unusual word or an unusual phrase to articulate his meaning in a very clear or very vivid way. And that Fronto is telling him to do that so it's clear when he's talking to other people. But in private, Marcus is also doing it so that it's memorable and meaningful. It sticks in his mind and it's easy for him to recall it when he needs to remember these ideas that he's learned from the philosophers.
Yeah, yeah. So you know incredible lot about Marcus Aurelius. And well, what I so like about your book is that it gives us a vivid picture of Marcus and the life he lived. He had was something, his life, and of course the man behind the Stoic meditations. And I must say, after reading the meditations of Marcus, my life really changed for the good. I think a lot of people would agree with me. So it gives us information about the history of Marcus and but also an insight on how he applied Stoic philosophy in his daily life as a leader, because he was quite a leader, and I think one of the best. And what he shows us, I think, how you can deal with all the stuff we have in our life, with desire and anger and anxiety and pain and dealing with mortality and sadness and loss. And as you know, the podcast is about leaders and specifically how they can benefit of the wisdom and the knowledge and the insights and the best practices of leaders. And I think Marcus is one of the best you can have as example of as a role model, because he's a little bit of a role model for me. But before we dive into the book, since I'm hooked on Stoicism, people often ask me if I can tell them what Stoicism is all about in a few words. Because one of the misconceptions I encounter is that Stoicism is about being without emotions, or with a stiff upper lip, you know. And so sometimes it's difficult to really explain what Stoicism is. But what would your answer be?
I think there's actually three answers to that. And so one of them is, I think it's important, as you've just touched on, to say what Stoicism isn't.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because the word Stoicism, when it's spelled in English, at least with a lowercase s, we say sometimes just say lowercase Stoicism, refers to an unemotional coping style or personality trait. And that's a much cruder, more simplistic, more modern concept. But Stoicism, when we write it with a capital S, like a proper noun, refers to this school of Greek philosophy that flourished for about 500 years.
Mm-hmm.
It's a much vaster, more complex, more nuanced subject. But I'll add something to that, which is the reason it's important, although there's some relationship between these two things. So this lowercase Stoicism is a simplification and a caricature of ancient Stoicism. And we find that also with the words cynic, which lowercase cynic just means someone who's kind of negative or skeptical. It used to be a whole school of philosophy.
Yeah.
Epicurean, today it just means somebody who enjoys gourmet food, whereas again it was a school of philosophy. Academic just means someone who's bookish or studious, whereas it was the name of a school of philosophy. Skeptic, sophist, a lot of these words have been corrupted in their meaning over time, like the word Stoic has.
Yeah.
But also, the reason that it's particularly important to distinguish these things, and many of the confusions on the internet are due to people just mixing up these two concepts. And it's very important for psychologists to distinguish them, because there's an existing body of research on lowercase Stoicism So, for example, there's a questionnaire scale called the Liverpool Stoicism Scale, or LSS, which is used, has a series of questions. It's used to assess this unemotional coping style.
Yeah.
And it's consistently found to correlate with poor maladaptive coping and poorer long-term outcomes. And people who suffer from chronic illness or have certain psychological problems. So there's a consensus among psychological researchers that lowercase stoicism is unhealthy. Dun, dun, dun. Right, so repressing your feelings, being ashamed of them, trying to conceal them from others is generally not healthy.
No.
Whereas capitalized stoicism is the philosophical inspiration for modern cognitive therapy, and that's one of our treatments of choice.
Mm.
So it's a healthy thing. So one of these things is bad for you psychologically, and one of them is good for you.
Yeah.
So it's very important to keep them distinguished in our minds. So that's the first thing I'd say. Capitalized stoicism is a fundamentally different thing from lowercase stoicism.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'd say a little bit of history. Like, so someone said, what is stoicism? And the question was more about where does it come from? What's the history? I say, well, it's a school of Greek philosophy that originated in 301 BC. It was founded by a Phoenician merchant from Cyprus called Zeno, who was shipwrecked near Athens, and it flourished in Athens, but then it was embraced by the Romans, who really loved the values of Stoicism and identified with them, and it became one of the predominant, if not the most predominant, schools of philosophy in the later Republic, and particularly and the early Roman Empire, right down to the time of Marcus Aurelius, and then after which we don't really hear that much about it. It kind of later becomes assimilated and superseded by Christianity.
Mm.
So it flourished for about 500 years in Greece and Rome and in other parts of the world. And it's a Socratic school of philosophy. It was inspired by the earlier teachings of Socrates.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
That's that. But if you want an elevator pitch as to what Stoics actually believe, so the big philosophy, it's hard to summarise, but I would say Stoicism teaches us that our character is fundamentally the most important thing in life, and our particularly traits like moral wisdom, like the way that we use things in life, is more important than the things that happen to us. And this is a moral philosophy, but for obvious reasons, one of its main corollaries is that it leads to psychological resilience.
Yep.
Because if you view external misfortune with relative indifference and you place more importance on your ability to cope with it, a consequence of that is that you're going to be more independent and more emotionally resilient, which is why psychologists are particularly interested in Stoic philosophy.
I think not only psychologists, but there are a lot of world leaders and a lot of people in business who are into Stoicism and have the meditations beside their bed.
Yeah, there's a lot of famous people. I gave a talk to the US Marine Corps recently, and the Marines are into Stoicism, partly because General Mattis, who was the US Defense Secretary for a while under Trump, is a Marine Corps general, was a big fan of the meditations, and said he thought every American should read the meditations. So it's a number of famous and influential people.
Yeah, that's true. But the Stoic philosophy exists for thousands of years already. And how do you explain the growing popularity of Stoicism in general, but almost also amongst business leaders?
In general, listen, I'll tell you, I've been fortunate enough to speak to a lot of people over the years. I've been involved with Stoicism for probably nearly 25 years now, and I've spoken to thousands of people over the years, and so I can just tell you what they tell me. So people tell me that they're interested in Stoicism because they see it as a Western alternative to Buddhism. So they're kind of looking for something that's like Buddhism, but it's more consistent with their cultural norms and values. They see it as a secular alternative to Christianity. So they want something that kind of has the worldview and the values of Christianity, or something that resonates with a guide to life, but that isn't based on faith or revelation or tradition. It's based on philosophical reasoning instead. They want something that's like CBT, but it's more philosophical.
Yeah.
So CBT lasts a while, and then you finish your treatment. And if people benefit from it, they often think, well, what do I do now?
Like,
you know, some of these ideas have implications for my whole philosophy of life. But CBT doesn't offer people a philosophy of life. So people see Stoicism as something that has the merits of CBT, but writ large on a bigger scale is more of a life philosophy. They see it as similar to academic philosophy that we study in universities today, but more practical and more down to earth. So sometimes philosophy students are drawn to Stoicism because they've studied Wittgenstein and Heidegger and things, and they thought, it doesn't really help me in day-to-day life, though. So I want something like philosophy, but more pragmatic and more down to earth.
Yeah.
So those are some of the things that they tell me that they find in Stoicism. And then there's another thing I would say, which is that I think many people today feel that they are manipulated by social media and the mainstream news media, and they're bombarded with frightening images, provocative media, distressing things about world events, climate change, political turmoil, that's beyond their direct control.
Yep.
And they have a negligible influence over these events. And it's rammed down their throats day by day in an increasingly hysterical manner and provocative manner.
Yeah.
It's designed, the media thrives on alarming us in order to grab and maintain our attention. So the media are competing for attention. That's how they make their money. And so they want to provoke arguments and conflict. You have to be careful about that. It took me a long time to realize. I thought Socrates warns his students about the sophists and how the ancient sophists would compete with one another and giving speeches, and they would try to be sensational, and they tried to win the biggest round of applause. And Socrates was basically saying, these guys are sellouts. Like, sometimes they sound like philosophers, but they're saying whatever wins the biggest round of applause.
Yeah.
And, you know, they don't really love truth. They're not really living in accord with these values. They're just telling audiences what they want to hear and trying to provoke a reaction from them. And I thought, well, that's really interesting. And I guess today we maybe have motivational speakers or some self-help gurus that are a little bit like that. And then one day it kind of dawned on me that actually the sophists never really went away. They just became digital, you know, and that Facebook and Twitter and these things are kind of our modern equivalent.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, the news that we get is determined now by algorithms based on how many likes things get. So the most sensational, most provocative, most upsetting things rise to the top.
It's true.
They captivate our attention.
Yeah.
And so Socrates and the Stoics would say, you guys need to arm yourselves against this kind of propaganda, this brainwashing that inevitably goes on. And Stoics needed to learn a kind of anti-rhetoric or counter-rhetoric to take a step back, you know, not to allow themselves to be wiped away by their rhetoric, by their impressions, and to do things rationally and objectively and look at the bigger picture. And I think many people feel the same way today when they log into Facebook or when they watch CNN or Fox News or whatever it is that the media they're consuming. They feel overwhelmed and bombarded and manipulated. And Stoicism appeals to them because it gives them a way of gaining some perspective, a certain amount of emotional attachment without sacrificing their core values. The Stoics wanted to strike a balance between, on the one hand, maintaining a commitment to courageous and disciplined action in the service of justice and moral wisdom, on the other hand, maintaining apatheia and not being overwhelmed and not freaking out, like not being damaged or perturbed by the process of engaging with life.
Yeah.
So they said, how can we avoid turning into nihilists? Like, or how avoid being driven, you know, to crazy and becoming neurotic because of the things that we're bombarded with. The Stoics wanted to strike that balance. And that appeals to people today because they feel bombarded with this provocative news
about
events beyond their control, but they want to somehow still live a meaningful life just amidst all of this noise.
Yeah.
And Stoicism seems to offer them a strategy that helps in that regard.
Yeah, that's the nice thing about the Stoic philosophy, I think, because it's an overall philosophy, you know. You can do with it whatever you want, but you talk about feeling overwhelmed, and maybe if you think it's okay, I would like to highlight a few Stoic techniques. And one of the techniques is about how to deal with anxiety. I know anxiety is one of your favorite subjects, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. And it's popular.
Yeah. So, and in one hand, anxiety is part of life, of course. But nowadays, a lot of things happen we don't have any control over. And you notice some people get overly anxious, and the Stoics have a few things to say about this and have practical ways of dealing with anxiety. And that's I think it's a very good thing, because, for example, focus on the things you have control over.
Mm-hmm. It always puzzled me. I think when I initially came across the Stoics, I thought I could see many, many parallels between what they were saying and cognitive therapy. But there's also this odd thing whereby I think people who are very immersed in the psychological research would look at certain ideas and think, that looks like it should work. It looks like it would fit in to our way of thinking, to a kind of cognitive approach. And actually, one of the things that the Stoics emphasize, this dichotomy of control, distinguishing between things that are up to us and things that aren't, kind of comes up sometimes in cognitive therapy, but it isn't one of the main focuses.
No.
And I think most cognitive psychologists can look at it and go, that looks like it's worth testing. It looks plausible as a strategy for coping with stress. It doesn't look like a crazy idea at all. It seems fairly common sense and simple. And so I that was one thing. I'm surprised that we're not doing more of that today in CBT.
Yeah.
You know, it's touched on in a number of ways.
Yeah.
You can do a lot more with that concept.
Yeah. Yeah, I think what you said earlier, it's quite interesting that people with anxiety try to control things by banging their head and often don't take enough responsibility, funny enough, for the things they actually can control.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, you gave the example of being anxious and then your heart rate goes up, and then they try to control the heart rate and try to get it down, but instead of focusing on outside things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so one of the things that is under our control is our appraisal, our our cognitive response to anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
How much time we spend thinking about things also is something that's under our control. So we don't control the automatic thoughts that pop into our mind spontaneously,
mm-hmm.
but we control what happens next. Like, do we spend the rest of the evening worrying about it?
Yeah, that's true.
Or do we stop and do something else instead?
Yeah.
So in therapy, we often find, of course, people are neglecting things that they could potentially do. Worry is one of my favorite examples, because when you ask clients about worry, it's almost a cliche that people will say, my worry is out of control, I can't control it. But actually, the research on worry shows that a lot of what goes on is voluntary, strategic thinking. People could stop it.
Yeah, that's true.
There are bits of it that are involuntary, but then there are other bits that are under our control. The same goes for anger, which is a kind of different topic. But the Stoics, if anything, are even more interested in anger than they are in anxiety.
Mm.
And so if somebody walks up and spits in your eye, like it's my kind of favorite example, of course, you're probably going to feel angry, right? So the Stoics would say you have this initial reflex-like automatic response. And we should accept that as normal and natural. But then you have control over what you do next.
Mm.
Do you continue to ruminate about revenge fantasies, like how you're going to get them back? You spend all the evening plotting how you're going to get revenge on them. And the Stoics would say, that's voluntary, you know.
Mm.
Not everybody does that.
No.
You definitely don't have to do that. You could go think about it differently, or you could go do something else instead.
Mm.
You could think about how you could understand what motivated them well and how you might get revenge on them. So, you know, the Stoics think that we, in general, are surprisingly unclear about this distinction. And it's interesting because the way Epictetus phrases it, he says some things are up to us and other things are not. Now, that's a truism. Like, it seems like a pointless thing to say. It's like saying some things are big and other things are small. Like, no one who could argue that some products are small and things are not.
No.
But somehow we forget it.
Yeah.
And we get confused about this distinction.
Yeah, that's true, that's true. So one another way of dealing with anxieties, they say depreciation by analysis. Or if you have a worrying thought, you can just repeat it for 10 or 20 times and then it loses its their meaning.
This is like an acceptance and commitment therapy, and that leads to a kind of cognitive distancing effect.
Yep.
Or the ACT researchers call it verbal defusion. I think this is an idea that the Stoics clearly... I've thought about this a lot, and I've looked very closely at the Stoic text, and it seems to me clear that they do have this idea, which is surprising, because it's quite a subtle concept, the idea that we should notice that our opinions and value judgments rather than just blending them or fusing them with external events. The way Aaron Beck described cognitive distancing, he says it's as if you're wearing coloured glasses, spectacles.
Yep.
And so you're wearing rose-tinted glasses, but you've had them on for so long that you forget you're wearing them, and you just assume that the world just looks rose-tinted.
Yep.
It's just the way that external things are. Until maybe someone else comes along that's wearing blue-tinted glasses, and they start telling you they see it differently, and then maybe you swap. And oh, yeah, actually, it's the glass that's coloured and not the world itself. And that's true of our value judgments.
Yes,
so
true.
If I lose my job and I see it as a catastrophe, I'm looking at events through catastrophe-tinted glasses, because there is no catastrophe in nature.
No.
Nature is indifferent. You know, I'm the one that views it in that way, and I might be entitled to impose that on it, but it's important for me to remember that it is something I'm imposing on the event. It's a way I'm choosing to look at it. And also, it's important for me to remember that other people might experience the same thing and view it as an opportunity or as less catastrophic, and that even I myself, 20 years from now looking back on it, probably won't view it as such a severe catastrophe. So there's an arbitrariness about the glasses that I'm choosing to wear, and so I should never confuse them with reality. I should always remember that they're constructs that I'm
about your own glasses.
Thanks for joining me today. If you'd like to hear more about me and the Max, go to themax.partners and don't forget to subscribe so you won't miss an episode.